Uh-oh.
Please wait.
Uh-oh. So Julie is going to talk about community and how community needs to be considered as a part of program definition.
Joe? Thank you, Sethi. Good morning. As I was sitting there in the audience, I was beginning to feel a bit, you know, like the person who's like in the community who's sort of being talked about and described by two separate entities, the program providers and scientific researchers. And it's funny because as I stand up here, I'm classified by CDC as a health scientist. I define myself as a social worker. But when I look at myself in the morbidity reports, I'm just a black woman in America. And, you know, it always looks pretty bleak for us. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what is the role of community partnership in this whole discussion about program science, because it isn't just shouldn't be, I would argue, that it shouldn't be just a dialogue between the providers and the scientists, but it should actually involve the people who experience these services. And, you know, we sort of live in this world of things being done for us and to us, but it's time for us to be thought about as a partner and thought about as somebody who can do things with you as well. So my task is to really describe some of that community participation, to talk about some strategies that you can use to enhance that relationship, and to talk about some examples from my own work at CDC. I'm like Susan, I'm going to start out with some definitions a little bit here about community, because I think we sort of often think of community either by race category or by geographical category, but what I would like to suggest to you that even within sort of the monolith black community, there are many communities that are different, and understanding that aspect becomes very important when you're either asking the research question or delivering the intervention. I'm also a Texan, so there's a sense of community about when you're a Texan, because we are a certain breed apart from everybody else. We are a whole nother country, as the ads used to say. So even understanding the geographical differences become very important, and I use that really not to be facetious, but think about the difference between somebody from rural South Carolina versus somebody from urban New York City. They may be African American, they may be female, but aren't their experiences going to be substantially different? And what are your interventions needing to look like? And what are the intervention questions even before you start to figure out what the solutions are? So what you have to appreciate is that geography impacts not only the definition of community by sort of the physical location, but also how people see themselves and understand themselves. I'm also going to mention a little bit, you hear people talk about a culturally sensitive intervention approach and a culturally competency. And I want to focus primarily on the last element here, the principled level of cultural competence and practice, which is respecting cultural integrity and accepting moral pluralism, which means understanding that life is really messy. And so easy definitions don't always work because things sort of overlap and interact with each other. And so you have to learn to appreciate the fact that it's going to be a very complex question. And it's not just having the right hip-hop language in your intervention message that's going to make your intervention successful, but it's really understanding that value systems might be different across different cultural groups. And just real quickly, why is it so important to really get a sense of culture and understanding that? Culture and ethnicity shape how people view health and illness, which influences their behaviors and responses when they are sick, what kind of treatment they will seek, and what they expect from that treatment. And I would submit to you that any part of this country, if you ask different people what they expect from the healthcare delivery system, they have different definitions of that. And sometimes, unfortunately, it's learned that, you know, you expect it to not serve you very well. I am struck by a comment. We were doing some work in Guilford County, North Carolina, and people kept talking about, well, we know there are two kinds of healthcare delivery. There's kind for the poor and there's kind for the rich. And these are folks that came into the STD clinic, and they really valued the STD clinic, and they said that they understood that, in fact, it was sort of like not, you know, regular kind of care. It was poor people's care. And so there's certain expectations about, yeah, I got to wait for all day long to get my service that I need. And unfortunately, that we've sort of taught people that, and people learn from their experiences. And so while you might think we need to expedite, you know, the experience with how fast they get seen in a clinic, people might not be worrying about that so much as they're worrying about that they get the care that they need, even if they know it's an 8-hour wait. If they get their problem taken care of, that's kind of okay. It's better than having nothing at all. So how do you actually bring people into the discussion? And one of the main ways we do that is we start out with a needs assessment process. And oftentimes these needs assessments are done from outside in. It means that the program providers and the scientists, if they do talk to each other finally, sit around and talk about what the problem is, and they decide then what needs to be done. And so you're sort of the person who's sitting there being discussed, but you don't have a voice in that communication. What I would submit to you is that this inside out is a very important way to begin to understand it, because people, if you talk to them, even folks who are long out of the mainstream and who live on the margins of our society, actually have networks and communication systems, and they understand what's going on and can tell you in a very candid and clear way what's really happening in their world and their experience, and help you really understand better what the questions are again and what the interventions need to be. I like these two quotes, and they couldn't come from farther apart in the political ideology. And it's a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. This is from W.E.B. Du Bois in 1903. And then the second quote, the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." And so I want to say that even if you look at opposite ends of the political spectrum, what you see are people who have this sort of general distrust of all of us do-gooders who are sort of sitting in here deciding what's best for you and how to help you. And again, I realize that I'm a member of multiple communities myself, and I have to be careful that I too don't become part of that process where we know what's best for you and we have the answers to your problems. So one of the new ways, or one of the most popular ways going on right now in terms of enhancing community involvement in these kinds of questions, is the participatory action research model. And I just highlighted a few key words here about what it means, engaging communities and researchers in a process which both contribute equally, and that's a very important part, contributing equally. A co-learning process, meaning that the researchers do not actually have all the answers, but that communities might actually have some very important answers to bring to the discussion as well. A method for systems development of local and community capacity building, so that, in other words, the scientists don't sort of come in mysteriously in cloak and dagger, do their magic work, give it to the program providers, and then everybody goes away, but that you actually begin to talk with the people who are actually receiving these services or in need of these services and help them understand how it is we do what we do. It's an empowering process, you know, that ends up by nurturing community strengths and problem-solving abilities. I think we are hearing increasingly this notion about community-level responsibility and communities needing to take responsibility for what's happening in their own neighborhoods. And I think that's a very important trend that we will see more of. And it's a new way to balance research and action. This is another model that I came across when we were doing some work for syphilis elimination. And what I appreciate about this model is that it actually sort of began to break down what these different elements are. And I want to point out this notion up here about the degrees of citizen power, because you can see that things begin to change as people become more engaged in the process. And over here you have, you know, the able power holders to educate or cure. So that's sort of the magic rescue. We've come here to help you. We've come here to fix the problem, whether they be research scientists or program providers. And then the next level going up this ladder, you have citizens have a voice but may not be heeded. So yeah, you might do a needs assessment. People might be trying to tell you something, but in fact, it doesn't quite fit your model or your paradigm, so we'll just sit it over here. It was a nice exercise, but you don't really involve it in the decision-making process. And then, Then the next level is citizens have real authority over the implementation of the program. So in fact, you get to a point where people who are actually receivers of your services actually have authority over how those services are delivered. Community participation is best achieved when the affected community members collaborate in equal partnership with health professionals to determine the health goals, implement the interventions, and evaluate the outcomes. And then again, another more simplified approach to this, and what we looked at, especially in syphilis elimination, is the different levels of participation. And our goal was always to get to this fourth level, where the actual communities who are affected actually define, decide, design, analyze, and even interpret the findings from the efforts that we are making in their communities. And so it's really a partnership approach. I like this next quote because it comes from talking about what it's like to sort of have people again come in and define your problem. When we want help, white America is nowhere to be found. When, however, you decide that we need help, you are there in a flash, solution in hand. You then seek to impose that solution on us without seeking our views, hearing our experiences, or taking account of our needs and desires. And while that's from an African American who was writing about the HIV epidemic and the government response, I think that there are many people who can describe that same experience, whether you are Native American, whether you are gay, whether you are rural and poor living in Appalachia or wherever. I mean, I think you have this sense of, we don't have a say in what happens to us and what you do with the tax dollars, by the way, that we actually pay. So it's very important, I would argue, that we have to have community involvement, and we learned that particularly with syphilis elimination. It helped us to actually be able to more effectively communicate with our stakeholders and people in the communities who needed these services. It helped us to restore, and it's important here to restore because there's a lot of distrust that is actually present right now, and so we had to restore that trust and then build on it and then maintain it. It actually improved the access of utilization of services because once people realize and truly trust that the government is here and it's here to help, then they might have actually different uptake on the services that the government might be providing, whether that be state, federal, or local government. It ensures a more culturally competent set of interventions, and it really helps to mobilize community capacity. And we had that in syphilis elimination efforts. So the role of community involvement in program science, I think it's very important to in the translation of findings, by helping to even identify what is the actual problem that we're trying to address and what is the research question that we need to answer. In the role of implementing the program, as Susan was describing a plane being built in the air, you know, there were passengers sitting on that plane. I wonder if they were getting part of the consultation, if they have some say in how that plane is constructed. Like, what's important to get fixed first? You know, so setting those intervention priorities, which becomes really important, particularly when you are thinking about limited resources, as we often have. Who decides what is the priority area to be responded to? Is it always going to be the scientists and the providers, or is it going to be actually the people who live in these communities and experience these problems? Do they have some say in what are the priorities? And then when you talk about tailoring an intervention, who better to help you tailor the intervention than the consumer of that intervention? If Madison Avenue played like that, would we buy tennis shoes and iPods? Don't they seek the consumers what you think you need, and then they build to that need as opposed to saying, you know what, let's just give you this, and you'll like it because we'll make you like it. And so then finally when you get to the notion of maintenance of the program, generating community investment, getting people to really be involved in it. What happens at the end of the day, on an 8-to-5 day, all the program providers and all the scientists go home, and there are people who live in these communities and experience this after 5 and on weekends. Where is the maintenance of the effort? Who's helping to sustain that? Where is the community collective action? If you don't feel engaged in how the decisions got made and what actions were taken, where's your buy-in? Where's your willingness to help sustain this effort, whether it's at the individual level, the neighborhood level, or community-wide level? And again, back to this notion of promoting community responsibility. When we're talking about things like STD and HIV in particular, a lot of that has to do with individual choices and what happens in these peer-to-peer relationships, what you're getting, you know, told, what you share within your neighborhoods. And so if I don't actually buy into what it is you're trying to tell me, whether it's to tell me to use condoms when I'm having sex with this partner versus that partner, or whether I need to worry about this STD over that STD, if I don't believe you in the first place because I think you've characterized my community in a very negative way, if I think you've stigmatized me and you've said you're all engaged in aberrant sexual behavior and so that's why you have such high STD rates, why should I trust your recommendations for behavior? And I often think how naive we are when we have a client sitting with us in a clinic and we are lecturing them about their individual choices and what they should be doing. And then that person, usually it's only one individual, that person goes back home to their relationship with a primary person who really matters in their life. And that person then talks to them about what they should be doing. Which side of that equation do you think that individual is going to come down on? Is the provider going to be the voice that sits on the shoulder and makes all the decisions? Or is it going to be the person I'm most intimate with? And oftentimes our interventions assume that people live sort of individually and don't have a network of experiences that then affect how they make their decisions. So what I would say to you is that if you really are going to move towards this program science model, in order for you to have better questions and better solutions, you're going to have to involve the people who experience these problems that generate these questions and experience the solutions to determine their effectiveness. So really quickly, just some of the best practices that we learned from syphilis elimination. We knew we had to have community partnership with community-based organizations and providers to get them engaged in the effort. We did that through organizing, you know, coalitions and task forces based on, again, community needs. And one of the things we quickly learned was we were the syphilis elimination campaign, but people wanted to talk about sexual health. And that meant we had to talk about something more broadly. We couldn't just be bug-driven because people didn't see it that way. They wanted to talk about a whole host of issues around their sexual health. We learned to develop ethnically and culturally sensitive STD prevention services for affected communities by, again, engaging these people in the discussion to learn what constitutes effectiveness and what constitutes culturally sensitive approaches. Many times that meant formal agreements with contracts, because what ended up happening is that people, providers might sort of say, yeah, we're going to have a relationship, we're going to do this, but it became very informal and wasn't necessarily going to, I'm getting the note now about my time, I didn't see other notes getting passed for other people. So it became very important to formalize that process and to make sure that we also had good outreach. And then most recently we had a stakeholders meeting with African American leaders to talk about the STD problem in African American communities. And again, the echoes were very much the same, that we were talking about there are multiple causes, getting to those social determinant issues, we have to have multiple perspectives, and that we have to have multiple stakeholders in the cause of decreasing STD disparities. So finally, my last slide is really that I started out with this title, and it's my favorite quote that I use forever and ever. I guess it's getting very old now, but take those like us who are willing to share and say we've had enough. We see what you're doing. Let us be part of the reforms. And so what I would say to you, if we're talking about good program science, you must let the community be part of that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. That was wonderful. And we will together make sure community is part of program science. Our next speaker is Dr. Charlotte Kent from